Hey, it's Zach from Vernacular Podcast and Third String. If you're listening to this, you've clicked play on one of our basketball podcasts on the Third String feed. And I'm telling you that there's going to be a lot more of this because we're moving our basketball podcast, Takes of the Game, to the Third String feed. So now you can hear Third String, our football show, Full Count, our baseball show, and now the Takes of the Game with Taylor Young and Ishan Knapp, all on the Third String feed. So starting September 10th, we are going to be no longer updating the Takes of the Game feed. All of that content will be right here for your listening pleasure. So thanks for listening and enjoy Takes of the Game. Welcome to the Takes of the Game podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Young, joined on the other line, as always, in Chicago, Ishan Knapp. How's it going, man?
I'm good. I'm ready to talk about advanced stats.
Nice. Yeah, this is our Advanced Stats for Dummies episode, requested by all you listeners out there. But first, Ishan, it's August. You know, there's not much going on right now in the world of the NBA. There's the NBA schedule, which just got released, which is quite interesting, but you can probably find a dozen or two dozen articles or podcasts out there analyzing the opening week of the NBA schedule and Christmas games. So figured we wouldn't talk about that too much, that we're going to maybe make this podcast a little bit more personal, talk about why we love the NBA. I mean, I guess people have figured out by now that we do really like the NBA if we're willing to talk about it every week. So how's that sound to you? You want to talk about why we're into this game?
Let's do it. And also, just want to mention quickly, it is August and there's no NBA stuff going on, but we have a riveting last week of the WNBA regular season coming up. Last playoff spot is up for grabs between the Dallas Wings and the Las Vegas Aces. And their young studs in Azja Wilson, who's probably going to win Rookie of the Year, and Kelsey Plum. And then the playoffs should be really awesome, as always, starting with a single elimination first round. So we do have great basketball on TV these days. But yeah, let's talk about why we love the NBA.
Yeah, Las Vegas Aces, former San Antonio Silver Stars. So I guess this is like the best season, or one of the best seasons they've had in a while. And it's not in San Antonio, sadly. But so, Ishan, I'm going to tell you a little story. I grew up like most kids in the 90s. I liked Michael Jordan, but you know, I only have a few vague memories of watching Michael Jordan play basketball. I do, strangely, have a memory of watching one of Michael Jordan's minor league baseball games on TV when I was like five, I guess, whatever year he was with the Birmingham Barons, is that what they were called?
That's right.
Yeah, so I have a vague memory of him striking out with the Birmingham Barons and me asking my dad why he was so bad at basketball. But started off...
Baseball.
Yeah, sorry, baseball. Yeah, Michael Jordan was, in fact, good at basketball. How's that for some deep analysis to start off the Takes of the Game podcast?
I mean, this is Takes of the Game. That's the take right there.
Yeah, I'm going to die on that hill that Michael Jordan was good at basketball. All right, so I come back from Cub Scout camp in 1999, and it was a really hot, brutal Texas summer, and spent a week out in the desert, and I come out and come back home, and the Spurs win their first championship against the New York Knicks. So, you know, I was nine. I kind of became, we were only an hour from San Antonio, became a Spurs bandwagon fan. The next year, my dad decides to take me and my mom and a friend, Zach Gorman, if you're listening, what's up, Gorm, to a Spurs and Milwaukee Bucks game at the Alamo Dome. You know, people who are familiar with the Alamo Dome will remember it had the giant blue curtain hanging in the middle of what should have been a football arena that the Spurs played basketball in. And the Bucks had Sam Cassell, Ray Allen, Glenn Robinson. Spurs actually lost this game, but really all I remember about the game was that I was waiting all game to catch a t-shirt, and the Spurs Coyote, best mascot in the world, comes out at one point with his t-shirt shooter, And we're like probably 50, 60 rows back. And I mean, you could still be lower level in the Alamo Dome watching a basketball game, but be really far back. And the Coyote shoots a t-shirt. It's the last shirt. And it comes up like all 60 rows to us. And me and Zach, my buddy, are anticipating this shirt. And we can start to tell as it's coming down, like it's coming right towards us. And we, you know, jump up on the seat. We have good positioning. We're boxing other people out around us. And out of nowhere, a chill runs down both of our backs and a hand reaches in front of us and grabs the shirt and Randy Moss style just pulls it in right in between us. And we both miss out on the shirt, realizing that we are soaked with Miller Lite or Bud Light, something like that. The guy behind us had dropped his beer in order to catch a shirt in front over 2 9-year-olds. But we didn't really care at that point. It was just such a great story that we were able to go home that night completely smelling like beer as 9-year-old kids, and just had a great story to tell all of our kids or all of our friends the next week. And at that point, I was pretty hooked on the NBA and became a Spurs fan after that. And on a more personal note, like my dad had never been to an NBA game, I don't think, until that point. And a couple years later, I just begged him, like, can we get a mini season ticket package? And, you know, that's what I had decided that I was into as a kid. And my dad really had only kept up with the NBA in the 80s. He was kind of a bandwagon Celtics fan. So was for the Celtics and all the Bird and Magic rivalries. And yeah, he got from the time I was in seventh grade on to when I graduated high school, got a 10-game season ticket package. We lived in Northwest Austin, so we drove down to San Antonio for, you know, 10 to 12 games a year. So, I mean, when your dad is like willing to do that to invest in something that you're passionate about, that really, that's what got me hooked originally on the NBA. And then I really felt like I kind of got to grow up with the Tim Duncan Spurs. So that's what caused me to fall in love with it. It's really, you know, something I hope I can do my kids one day is, you know, invest in what they're interested in. I would love for it to be the NBA, but yeah. So that's at least why I started to love it. And then I also had a brief flirtation where I cheated on the Spurs and loved the Vinsanity Raptors. So
That's great. I think it's funny that you grew up with the Duncan Spurs and I grew up with the Jordan Bulls, because, you know, I saw a 538 article once about how you're way more likely to be a diehard fan when you grow up if your teams are good, particularly between the ages of like 6 and 10. And the Bulls won titles when I was 6, 7, and 8. So yeah, actually the first season I ever followed professional basketball, I was 5 years old. It was 1995, 1996. And my family had like just moved to Chicago from India 3 years earlier. And basketball was kind of like one of the American culture things that my parents, my dad in particular, were getting into. So like we would watch some Bulls games, and it just so happened that that first year of me watching, my team won 72 games and the championship. And, you know, basketball and the Bulls were pretty much anything, the only thing anyone talked about when I was in elementary school. And, you know, I was a driveway shooter type. We had a hoop in our front driveway, and I would probably spend like 2 or 3 hours a day shooting like my entire childhood, which is actually still something I do. And so that's where I was born. I met Steve Kerr once when I was a kid. That was pretty cool.
So did I.
Oh, nice. Oh, yeah. Yep. It was because he was on the Spurs after the Bulls, right?
Yeah. My friend Zach, who got the beer spilled on him, was a really good basketball player. And several years later, I guess after Steve Kerr had already retired, but he was a TV analyst at the time, it was before he was the GM of the Suns, Zach had gone to the Spurs basketball camp one summer in San Antonio, and all the people who went to the Spurs basketball camp got invited to a regular season game that next year, and you got to stay after the game, and like they advertised it as like ex-Spurs champion is going to talk to all the campers after the game, and it was Steve Kerr. And I remember it was Steve Kerr and Danny Ferry, actually, and somebody asked him about the game where he scored the 12 points, which seems really small, but hit the 4 threes against the Mavericks in the Western Conference Finals game 6 in 2003. and they asked Steve Kerr and Danny Ferry, like, what does it feel like to get that hot? And Steve Kerr just had an epic troll job on Danny Ferry and said, well, Danny's never been that hot, so I'll answer the question. So yeah, I know he got to meet Steve Kerr after he talked to everybody, so it was pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Which one of the 90s Bulls did you like try to model your game after the most?
Definitely Steve Kerr.
Nice.
I'm definitely a stand there and shoot threes kind of guy.
Yeah. No, I felt like it was funny because like when I would play horse and stuff, like I had the Tony Parker teardrop, the Manu Ginobili reverse layup, and then the Tim Duncan bank shot from the elbow, like all down like that. And I could just nail all three of those like signature shots from each of those like guys. Like, and I was like terrible in like game situations, but I was always good at horse because I think I had mastered those three things. So
yeah. Nice.
So when did your like fanhood transition from growing up in Chicago to like, why is the NBA still something that you're interested in?
I don't know. Why don't you go first? I don't know if I have an answer to that question.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up with the Spurs and I feel like the Spurs were one of the most consistent parts of my life from when the first time I remember seeing Tim Duncan play, I was 9 years old. It was right before I went to that Cub Scout camp that I mentioned earlier. And then the last time I saw Tim Duncan play, I was a 26-year-old man and married. And so it's like he spanned most of my life and was like more consistent than a lot of people. So the Spurs were always that big part. But I think where it transitioned from me not just loving the Spurs, but more into loving the NBA is, you know, I've really kind of consistently loved when I was a kid, I loved three things. I loved sports because of like the shared experience it provided with my friends, with my dad. And then I loved movies and books and stories. And then I loved professional wrestling because of the drama. And I felt like as my NBA fanhood became more sophisticated, it was sort of a combination of all three things. It provided a shared experience. It has great narratives and great stories. And it has the drama of so many, professional wrestling events and movies. So it kind of combined those three things that I loved when I was a kid, where it has the personalities, the characters, and, you know, just was a history major in college, got obsessed with like the history of the NBA. Just think it's so fascinating how it started. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I watch a lot of sports, and I do think basketball is definitely the best sport to watch or play or think about in a lot of ways. I think it's more action-packed than baseball. I think, I don't know. I don't want to defend why it's better than the other sports. It's my favorite sport. But I think the reason – it's hard. I don't know. It's hard to say exactly what it is, but I think the reason that I'm so invested in basketball and in the NBA is just – and in sports in general, is that it's just kind of, there's just so many metaphors for life. And it's just like a thing to believe in and a thing to care about. And I feel like handling the emotional ups and downs of sports is kind of, which is very emotional for me, a lot of times, is kind of like practice for handling the emotional ups and downs of other things in life. And just like being able to bounce back and believing in things that are, you know, difficult to imagine happening, but then sometimes happen. And I think also my investment in the guys on the team in particular, I'm really like, I care deeply about the human beings that are playing basketball and feel like my emotions are wrapped up a lot of times in players more than just the jersey they're wearing.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, and I think that basketball really provides that opportunity to connect with players on a deeper level than other sports. And you and Zach, you know, y'all got in a discussion about Mike Trout on the Third String podcast, which was really good this week. But, you know, I think a lot of times what people talk about baseball players and football players is they're either wearing helmets or they're wearing hats, and there are more people on the field at a given time. The camera is not always on that specific player. And in basketball, you know, we're constantly seeing players' expressions and their emotions, and we're experiencing the ups and downs with a more one player can change a basketball game much more than it can change in football and baseball, and there's less players on the court. So it does provide that intense emotional connection to where it's like, you know, I've loved a lot of teams on various different sports, but I've never had a connection with a particular player like I've had with, you know, several members of the Spurs, because you just feel like you're on such a journey with your favorite basketball players, and you don't always feel like that with your favorite players on other teams. So
I wept in the fetal position at my in-law's house before they were my in-laws, before we were married, actually, for 90 minutes when the Bulls traded Luol Deng. And they understood. They just were like, oh, like, we get it. Nice. I mean, Luol, you know, all his citizenship awards. And I think he won an award from, like, the United Nations for his work with refugees in Africa and, like, builds, like, schools and his foundation builds, like, schools and hospitals in South Sudan. I think Luol Deng is the best guy in the NBA. And, yeah, it's, like, moments like that that are... I mean, half the toasts of my wedding were about, like, oh, like, if Ishan loves his wife as much as he loves the Bulls, like, she's in good shape.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah, hey, Luol Deng is getting rewarded with, a $25 million contract from the Lakers next year, so he deserves
it. I've said many times, not jokingly, that if any NBA team was going to give out a bad contract, the best person for humanity to give that bad contract to is Luol Deng, because, like, the highest percentage of that money is going straight to, like, the people who need it the most in the world.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he'll actually end up being valuable on the Lakers because they kind of need some level-headed people on that team right now.
I believe he could still be a good player. I don't really understand why the Lakers signed him and then never played him, but whatever.
Yeah, we can talk more about the Luol Deng impact on the Lakers in another episode, but real quick, I do think he will play more this year because I think, you know, last year they were one, sort of tanking, but two, they were really trying to fill out their young players and see what they had last year. And I think, like, LeBron, you know, probably wants to play with veterans. So I think he will actually have a role on this team, provided his body can recover from, you know, injuries that he's had over the previous years. So.
All right. Well, I have a lot of advanced stats stuff to talk about, so we should get to that at some point.
Yeah, no, I want to. So we're going to kind of transition. I think part of why you love the NBA now is because of it's blended your love of numbers and your love of data with a sport that you really love. And in previous episodes, you know, you will throw around some jargon that maybe not all of our NBA fans are familiar with. And some advanced stats terms. So we've had some requests from some listeners for us to do an advanced stats for dummies episode. So I'm going to, I will admit that, you know, a lot of these stats I might not be well versed in, but I'm going to act for the rest of this episode like I know completely nothing. So first I'm going to ask you, why should someone care about advanced stats as an NBA fan? And then I'll let you work through your list of, like, which advanced stats you think would be important for an NBA fan to know.
Yeah. Okay. So I actually was going to start this off with, like, a little bit of a philosophical comment, which is that I obviously think that advanced stats are super, I think they're really helpful in understanding the game. I think if you want your team to, if you want to improve the quality of your opinions about how good certain players are, who you want your team to sign or trade for or draft, how good your team is going to be in a certain season, things like that, I think that advanced stats, like, help you understand basketball better. And that they're basically, you know, advanced just means stuff that's not traditionally printed in the box score. Often they're, like, super, super simple statistics that are just kind of, like, better than the other super simple statistics that people talk about more. Like, advanced often just means less popular than, like, points and rebounds, but not really more complicated, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I think that's why I think should, quote unquote, I would never say anyone should do anything, because basketball is for enjoyment and, like, do whatever makes you enjoy your hobby the most. And if that's not stats, then whatever. But I think like they're useful in understanding basketball better and knowing more about how well players are actually doing and how well they're actually doing at certain things. But I do actually worry a lot about my advanced stats obsession and like the increasing advanced stats popularity, in the sense that I think one of the things that's cool about sports is that they're extremely accessible and like can bridge a lot of social, economic, educational divides. And I'm concerned that advanced stats are introducing an angle in which sports are becoming another thing that's kind of like divided in society. And like, I don't want that to happen. Like, I want sports to be the thing that like I, a dorky PhD student, can talk about with like my pickup basketball friends that like didn't go to college, or like, I want it to be a thing that I can talk about with like anyone I meet. And I don't want it to be like another thing that's like, oh, you like elitist person are talking down to me with your nerd numbers or something. So I worry about that. And I think that's like a real concern, and that I don't think we should ever get to a point where like advanced stats are like a thing you have to know to watch sports. I think everyone should be able to like watch sports and have fun and like talk about whatever they think is interesting about the game.
Yeah. And hopefully people see that, where I think you and I are really trying to approach, you know, I think we, you know, obviously our love of the NBA started off with, you know, fanhood as kids, but I think like we are very interested in a lot of ways in different things about the NBA now. So we would encourage all of our listeners to like tell us what interests them about the NBA, what current trends they find exciting. Cause I mean, I like talking about the NBA so much with other people, because I feel like people have so many different perspectives. And I know that SB Nation podcast last year referred to the NBA as blood sport, like the Jean-Claude Van Damme famous movie, the blood sport ultimate fighting tournament, where all these people are different, bringing different styles and different strategies, but still fighting the same tournament. And maybe that's changed a little bit in the last couple years of the NBA, where people are maybe more starting to play the same style. But I do think that people are always bringing in different perspectives and valuing different things. But yeah, let's try to understand.
So the other one thing I wanted to toss in about advanced stats is that I think often an advanced understanding of statistics is just telling you what's wrong with all the statistics that exist, be they the basic ones or the advanced ones. And often I think what it comes down to is like people who know a lot of stats about the NBA understand the flaws of all the stats well enough that they know that like actually you really have to watch the games to understand things like help defense and ball movement. And like, you know, you brought up a great point on one of our previous podcasts about how like Chris Paul and James Harden hit shooters right in their pocket, and you might be able to get like a super advanced stat on how well guys shoot off the catch and shoot when Harden's throwing them the pass versus when like, you know, someone else is from who's not as good of a passer is throwing them the pass. But like even that is subject to some sorts of luck. So like there's a lot of things that I think are super important in basketball that you need to, like, you need to watch games to know who boxed out. Like the rebounding stats are, I think, like a really bad measure of rebounding impact a lot of the times. And so I think a lot of what advanced stats are telling you is actually what you cannot use statistics for, which I think is a point. I think advanced stats people often are like, actually, like you really need to watch the games because you're missing a lot with every, like even if you have every stat in the world, you're missing a lot. And I think that's something that gets mischaracterized a little in the like nerds versus non-nerds debate.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's get started.
All right. Go for it. What's first on your list?
All right. So I have divided the advanced stats into four broad categories. And I think what's easiest is to like describe each of the categories and then go through a few of my favorite or least favorite stats in each of the categories and talk about like what each category brings to the table. So the four categories, the first one is box score statistics, which is basically the ones everyone knows, plus some other ones that have fancy names that I actually personally think are not very useful, but get thrown around a lot and talked about a lot. These are things that are basically calculated from the box score statistics that everyone knows, like points, rebounds, steals, shots made and missed, whatever. Then the second bucket that I'll put stats into is what I consider to be better versions of the box score statistics. So this is like, instead of field goal percentage, we could have something called true shooting percentage, Instead of rebounds, we could have something called rebound rate and stuff like that. So I'll get into those. And I think that these are like pretty useful stats. The third bucket is lineup data, which has a whole lot of stuff under that bucket. But this is actually probably my favorite category of statistics. So we'll get into that. And then the fourth bucket.
And for all of you listeners out there who play the lineup data drinking game with Ishan each episode, you probably have a nasty hangover after you listen to each of our podcasts. So
it's true. And part of the reason I love lineup data is that I think it's the only thing that can capture all the stuff that we can't measure well in statistics, like help defense or ball movement, stuff like that, that will affect how well your team is doing, but that we don't have a measurement of, comes through in data that's measuring just how well your team did when you were on the court.
Yeah. Fourth category.
So we'll get into that. So the fourth category, which I think is super cool and is kind of in its infancy of being available to regular people rather than just like the analysts for the team, is play type data. And so this is stuff like, how well did this player do in isolations, in pick and rolls, both on offense and defense? How well did they do when they were guarding the pick and roll ball handler versus the when they were guarding the pick and roll roll man? And by how well, it's usually like points per possession that were scored on that play type. So like if they were guarding the pick and roll ball, all possessions that, you know, LeBron guarded the pick and roll ball handler for the entire season, what was like the points per possession of the other team? Or like spot up shooting, shooting off the dribble, shooting off picks, stuff like that. And this is something that we only have this bucket because of this new type of data collection that's been going on for a few years, where basically cameras track where each of the players and the ball is at every moment the entire game on the court. So I think that's another like really cool and like kind of in its infancy bucket of data, but there's some cool stuff that is available online that we can talk about. But yeah, let's go through bucket by bucket. So the first bucket I said is one I don't like a lot, and this is box score statistics. So there's a few things. There's like box, there's four in particular that people talk about a lot. There's PER, per, which is John Hollinger from ESPN made this up a few years ago.
Stands for player efficiency rating.
Right. I didn't even remember that. Then there's value over replacement player, VORP, box score plus minus, BPM, and win shares. I think win shares actually use a combination of a little bit of lineup data, but mostly box score data. And basically what these statistics do is they have like some fancy formula that multiplies, divides, adds the box score statistics that we all see, like points, rebounds, steals, whatever, and comes up with like some summary that's a combination of all those box score statistics that we're used to, and uses that as like an aggregate measure of a player's value. And I personally don't really care about these statistics, which is why I don't remember what they stand for or know that much about what they are, because I think that like we know the flaws in box score statistics, and this is just like some function of box score statistics that's been made to sound fancy, but is not actually doing anything fancy. And in my view, is not adding much beyond just knowing the guy's box score statistics that you can read, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to talk about these too much because, like I said, I'm not a huge fan of them. A perfect example of where a box score statistic falls short, I think, that I like to give is when Pau Gasol was on the Bulls, he was, you know, in the top few guys, top 10, maybe top 5 in the NBA in rebounds per game. But if you watch the Bulls, you knew that Pau Gasol was killing the Bulls' ability to get rebounds because he never boxed anybody out. And he just stood under the basket with his arms high in the air, ready to grab rebounds, but with like the guy he was supposed to box out roaming freely and getting plenty of rebounds too. So the Bulls were like a worse rebounding team because of Pau Gasol, but he was racking up all these rebounds. So it's like, you know, that's just one example. Everyone knows that like steals and blocks are like a very small percentage of what's important on defense. So I don't think I need to go on too long about why I don't like these box score based statistics.
Yeah. And I think box score data, a lot of times, at least my understanding is what, you know, that's typically people will over inflate people who show up in the box score, as opposed to, you know, there's a lot of things going on a basketball court where it's like, you know, Danny Green or JJ Redick running around a lot and creating an open shot for another person isn't necessarily going to show up on any measurable box score stat. So they talk about that a lot in the David Halberstam book, Breaks of the Game, where why, you know, the 70s Blazers team was so good is they had several players, even Bill Walton included, who didn't have stats, who showed up on the box score. So they were able to get players who, you know, overperformed what the market said that their value was, because the market only valued things that showed up and that people could read in the newspaper. But I guess, you know, there is a trend now to where, and, you know, it's been going on for quite some time in basketball where people are valuing things that show up in more than the box score. But how do you think that, like, PER specifically, because I think that's the most well-known stat of the advanced stats in the box score category, like, what would an example of someone's PER being overvalued be?
I honestly haven't even learned that much of the statistic, but I would say, like, Zach LaVine, he scores points. He does it somewhat efficiently, but he's like a space cadet on defense, and PER doesn't pick that up.
Yeah.
So one advantage you mentioned, going back to the newspaper days, of box score-based statistics is that they're kind of the only ones we have for historical comparisons, because a lot of the other statistics didn't start getting measured until the last couple decades, or sometimes even the last few years in the case of the player tracking data. And so, you know, sometimes we need them, but like when we can do better, we should, basically.
Yeah.
So now the next bucket I'm going to get to is what I consider to be just basically better versions of the box score statistics. And really the key thing in this is just adding a little bit more context, maybe even just getting the right way to measure a box score statistic. So, but the first example I'll give here is turnover rate. This is on Basketball Reference. It's TOV percentage. And basically what turnover rate does is just adjust for the fact that, like, guys who have the ball a lot are going to be creating more turnovers, even if they're extremely careful with the ball. So, like, if Chris Paul has three and a half turnovers per game and Trevor Ariza has half a turnover per game, it doesn't mean that Trevor Ariza is doing a better job taking care of the ball, because he's just not involved in as many plays as Chris Paul as a ball handler and a finisher. And so what turnover rate does is it's basically just the percentage of plays that finish with that player taking the shot or turning it over. It's like turnovers as a percentage of all plays that ended by that player. So it's just giving you a little bit more context on the turnover statistic. So, like, Trae Young had like five turnovers per game at Oklahoma last year, but his turnover rate was actually like middle of the road, not too bad, because he had the ball the whole game. So that's one example of a statistic I like. Another one I think is pretty cool is the usage percentage. So this is better box score stats, by the way. I would say if you're someone that's trying to learn just a couple of the stats from this entire episode, you should learn the ones in this category, because they're the most commonly used, and I think the easiest to understand and the most useful in, like, in terms of how much you're going to see them around. So usage percentage is basically just the percentage of a team's possessions that player ends with a shot or a turnover. So it's kind of like the denominator from turnover rate. And so what's interesting about usage percentage is that if a guy's got the ball more, you expect that they're having to take tougher shots on the margin. So, like, you know, Trevor Ariza might be getting a lot of pretty open threes because Chris Paul and James Harden, well, I guess he's not on the Rockets anymore, but used to create them for him. But, you know, LeBron on the Lakers might be having to take really tough shots and have the ball a lot. And so when you're looking at the other efficiency-oriented statistics, which I'll get to in a second, usage percentage is a nice way to contextualize them, because historically we see that, like, the really high shooting percentage-based stats are going to be associated with the players that take fewer shots, because you usually take easier shots when you take fewer shots. And usage is just kind of the easiest way to measure that. So usage, again, that's just total field goal attempts plus roughly half of free throw attempts plus turnovers. Yours divided by total for the team. So it's like, out of the shots and turnovers, how many did you take? So for a guy like LeBron, or like, you know, James Harden, their usage percentage is going to be like in the mid-30s. 35% of the possessions will be ended by them. And for like the lower usage players, it'll be maybe in the teens. Usage is also a good way to see whether sometimes a player who shouldn't be ball hogging is ball hogging. So Dwayne Wade, a couple of years ago, he's on the Bulls, was 10th in the NBA in usage, despite being way below average in how efficiently he was using those possessions.
And usage rate, you know, also really exposes flaws, I think, in certain players' games when you can look at several players' numbers when their basic stats like points, rebounds, assists might be really close. But say, you know, last year when Russell Westbrook won the MVP, I think is a perfect example. People pointed to his triple-double, where James Harden and LeBron James were both very close to a triple-double themselves, whereas Russell Westbrook's usage rate was 40.8%. It was the highest usage rate, I believe, in history. Correct me if I'm wrong, Ishan, where James Harden almost averaged a triple-double with a usage rate of 34.1. LeBron James had one of 29.7. Kawhi Leonard, his last full healthy year on the Spurs, had a usage rate of 31.2. He obviously wasn't close to a triple-double, but did finish third in MVP voting. So it really, kind of pokes holes and shows the inefficiency in which Westbrook achieved his triple-double by showing that usage rate.
So speaking of efficiency, the next two highly related, very similar statistics I'm going to go over are basically better versions of shooting percentage. And so the problem with shooting percentage, of course, is that it doesn't adjust for how much the shots were worth. So when you just have shooting percentage and you have a guy that shoots a lot of threes, it's not adjusting for threes and it's not adjusting for free throws. So if you have a guy with a really high free throw percentage who doesn't get to the line that much versus a guy with a high free throw percentage who gets to the line a lot, then that's how efficiently they're converting their shot attempts into points is going to be different based on how many threes they're shooting, how well they're shooting those threes, how many free throws they're shooting, and how well they're shooting those free throws. So instead of just doing overall field goal percentage, a statistic that I consider to be much better is something called effective field goal percentage. And basically, it's super simple. This is, I think, the best example of what I was saying, that advanced stats don't actually have to be advanced. They're just different stats. So field goal percentage is just baskets over shots. It's just made shots over attempted shots. And effective field goal percentage is just points scored over potential points scored if all the shots were two-pointers. So it's basically effective field goal percentage. Instead of doing shots divided by attempts, it's just points divided by two times attempts. So it's like if all of your shots were two-point field goals, what would your field goal percentage be based on the number of points you scored? So if you make a third of your three-pointers, you're shooting 33% from the field, and all your shots are three-pointers, then your effective field goal percentage will be 50%, because obviously you got an extra point for those shots. And so this is like just as easy to calculate as field goal percentage, because it's literally just one number divided by another number. But it's just giving credit for guys who were taking three-point shots.
And do you think there are any flaws in effective field goal percentage? Because what I would look at as the flaw is if you're making, and I think, you know, spreading the floor is obviously good. It creates a more open game. It maximizes shot opportunities for different players on the field or on the court. But a lot of times what I feel like is happening now is like, say, Dwayne Dedman on the Hawks, who's a very athletic, rim running big, you know, could probably be somewhat of a poor man's DeAndre Jordan, who the Hawks are now having shoot threes, where that's taking a very athletic center away from around the basket where he could really flourish just so he can shoot 2 to 3 three-point attempts a game. Where I think, you know, the Spurs, what they really try to do recently in their keeping the mid-range jumper game alive, you might not view that as efficient, but, you know, I think even with Kawhi Leonard and LaMarcus Aldridge the past 3 years, you know, what the Spurs have done has said, hey, let's not focus on so much of what type of shot it is, but if someone is shooting any type of shot at a high clip, that is still efficient. And so is that where effective field goal percentage at times can be overinflated, where it creates too much of a reliance on threes to where you can get inefficient three-point shooters or not accurate three-point shooters shooting too many threes?
So I don't think so. I think that's a flaw. I think what you're arguing is more for a flaw in team strategy than a flaw in the statistic. I don't think I agree necessarily with your argument, but I think one thing worth noting is that layups are always the most valuable shot. So even for the really good three-point shooters, their effective field goal percentage is always highest in the paint. And basically, it is just like the mid-range shot that gets penalized by effective field goal percentage. But I would say, like, basically the goal of each possession in basketball is to score the highest number of points possible on that possession, and that'll give you the highest possible number of points in the game. And all effective field goal percentage is doing, and it doesn't do anything about free throws. So the other stat I'm going to get to in a second incorporates free throws also. But all effective field goal percentage is doing is telling you what were the expected points you scored on that possession. And so it's never better to score fewer points. It could be better to take mid-range jumpers if you're making bad three-pointers shoot threes that they shouldn't be shooting or whatever, but then in a large sample in the long run, you're going to end up with a better... Any strategy that you say is better should be better in this statistic if it's actually better. And it might be that, like, context matters, and, you know, in the playoffs, you can't get as many threes. So it might be that eventually there's going to be some context in which you'll do better. But it should come through in that statistic. Yeah. Anyways, so I'm going to move on and just quickly, a close cousin of effective field goal percentage is true shooting percentage. And all that does is incorporate free throws into effective field goal percentage. So there, the denominator is shot attempts times two, or sorry, it's basically it's shot attempts plus 0.44 times free throw attempts. And the reason it's 0.44 instead of 0.5 is because like 12% of free throws come on and ones. And so two free throws isn't exactly equal to one field goal. But basically you should think of it as like two free throws is like one shot. So you multiply the free throw attempts by half to get shots in the denominator. And then it's just the exact same thing. It's just points scored divided by potential points scored.
And true shooting percentage really exposes, you know, the DeAndre Jordans of the world, right? Who from just a basic field goal percentage are always shooting in the high 50s, but then might have abysmal free throw percentages. So it's, you know, shedding some light on the fact that their true shooting percentage, because they're missing so many free throws, they're not as efficient as their field goal percentage might lead you to believe.
So that's half right, but actually, like, even bad free throw shooting, now DeAndre's bad enough that this doesn't qualify for him, but even bad free throw shooting is usually better than any shot from the field. Because if you think about it, the average effective field goal percentage was 52.1% last year in the NBA. And so that's like the average shot from the field basically is getting you a 50. It's like if you're a 53% free throw shooter, then you're doing better than average from the field. DeAndre is like a 40% free throw shooter, so this doesn't apply to him. But he also has so many dunks that he actually, even in true, and he doesn't go to the line all that much, and it doesn't hurt him quite that much. So he's actually near the top in true shooting percentage. But keep in mind, he has a low usage and he gets his shots mostly created by other guys, which will come up in the play type category. Okay, so let's move on from this category. I think the key things are like usage, turnover rate, true shooting percentage, and effective field goal percentage are stats that are like super simple to understand that I think all basketball fans should generally be able to know. Okay, so the next category, and we're going to go maybe a little bit faster to try to finish this up within an hour. But the next category you've heard me talk about all the time is lineup data stats. So I don't know how much I even need to go into this because I've gone into this on a lot of previous podcasts, but I will say a few things about it. So it's basically, there's various levels. There's raw lineup data, which is just how many points. Oh, the other thing, so we're talking about getting the context right and getting the denominator right. So one thing that I like about lineup data stats is that they regularize everything per 100 possessions, so that the number of minutes you play as a player isn't helping you in these stats. And also whether your team plays like a fast pace or slow pace isn't helping you have a artificially better job on offense or defense. So if your team plays really fast, like the 7 seconds or less D'Antoni Suns, your team might get 20 extra shots per game and everyone has more points per game. But that doesn't actually matter because the other team also got 20 extra possessions. And what matters is like winning per possession. So I like that these stats are per 100 possessions. But basically the raw stats are just points scored for your team per 100 possessions versus points not scored when you were on the court. Points scored by the other team. So that's just called offensive rating, which is just points per 100 possessions, and defensive rating, which is points given up per 100 possessions. And then like the slightly more, you know, detailed version of that, which you can find on NBA.com, is how did your team do when you were off the court? Now, naturally, when you're off the court, a lot of other things are different. When stars sit, a lot of other bench players play. There's bench players on the other team in. And so taking these on-off numbers is actually like usually a pretty good proxy of which players are like at the top of the MVP race and things like that. Usually the players that you would expect are the players that do well in these on-off statistics. But basically, you can take it a step further, and you can take it a step further manually in simple ways. There's a really cool website called NBA Wowie that I use a lot, where you can pick any combination of players on the bench and on the court and look at their team's net rating, which again is offensive rating minus defensive rating. So basically like net points you're leading by per 100 possessions. And so you can, on this website, you can be like, oh, like how are the Warriors doing when Steph is on the court, but KD, Klay, and Draymond are all on the bench? Or like Steph and Draymond are on the court, but KD and Klay are on the bench, or any combination like that. You can look at the data. So I think that stuff's really cool. And all that you can do by yourself without, it doesn't require any fancy statistics. And I think it adds a lot of context to the game, to understanding how different lineups are working. On that note, actually, there's a really cool tool on this website, NBA Math, which actually one of my high school friends, Adam Frommel, is the creator of this website. So, you know, maybe a little bit of a biased shout out, but it's a really great website. And this tool basically allows you to, for every team, it just produces a graph of minutes played for each lineup. And you can do 5-man lineup, 4-man, 3-man, 2-man lineups, and net rating of that lineup. So you can look at what are the most, and then if you click it, it shows you who the players are, the number of minutes, and the net rating. And so basically this just allows you to super quickly in one visual on nbamath.com look at what were the really heavily used lineups and what were the really successful lineups for each team. So that's all stuff that's like really easy to understand and really easy to do. And then obviously what you've heard me talk about a lot on the podcast is kind of the next level of lineup data is using like really fancy statistics to try to adjust for other things that happened, like who was on the court on the other team. And so that's where you get statistics like ESPN's real plus minus, which that this is like the type of advanced stats that's actually like using advanced statistics, not just like simple statistics that people don't talk about a lot. And so that's basically trying to give you the thought experiment of like controlling for how good the other 9 guys are on the court. How much did this player affect winning per 100 possessions, basically? And then there's another version of that statistic by this guy, Jacob Goldstein, I think his name is, from Nylon Calculus. And I think they're starting a new website called B-Ball Index, which is going to launch soon that I'm excited about. And that's called Player Impact Plus Minus, which is basically box. It's basically the same thing as Real Plus Minus, but it's using some box score data to make sure that you can't have small sample size problems where guys who played a few minutes and their team happened to do really well in those few minutes are like at the top of the leaderboard. And so all that's doing is like using some box score data to inform the guys who played very few minutes, basically, so that you don't have like a guy who played 10 minutes of garbage time leading the NBA in real plus minus. But it's basically a similar tool. And then there's other, you know, related tools. Like there's a luck adjusted on off rating, which adjusts for how well the other team and your teammates shot free throws and how well guys shot open threes on the other team while you're on the court. Because it's well known that like open threes by the other team is something that you don't have control over, much like free throws by the other team. So you want to adjust for whether like they randomly shot well on open shots while you were in the game, stuff like that. So there's all these deeper layers of lineup data, but the top layer is just basically stuff that we can observe really directly, like when these teammates were on the court, how well did the team do versus when they were on the bench and other guys were on the court. So I think it's really useful precisely because I think there's so much stuff that we don't measure well, like help defense, which I will always go back to as my favorite example.
Well, I felt like that was just like watching someone go 8 for 11 from three. You just got really ablaze there for a minute talking about lineup data. So
thanks. I love lineup data.
Yeah, I know.
So maybe we should move on to the last category, which is, I think, the best category of statistics, but also the one that's like generally least publicly available. And this basically, I talked about it a little at the top of the show. Basically, the last category, play type statistics, just takes specific types of plays like isolations, post-ups. So the categories I have here in front of me at the website I'm looking at are isolations, spot up shooting, shooting off screens, shooting off dribble handoffs, pick and roll ball handler, pick and roll roll man, transition, cuts, and putbacks. And I think there's another one for shooting off the dribble. And all that does is it shows for all players in the NBA, when they had an isolation, what was the expected points per possession that they were expected to score. And also one piece of context that I should note is that roughly really good for offensive rating is around 110 plus points per game. So I think the worst defense in the NBA last year was the Kings. And they gave up, I said points per game, but I meant per 100 possessions. And the Kings gave up 110 points per 100 possessions. So that's kind of like the mark of really good offense or really bad defense. And then I can't remember the other end of the spectrum, but I think like 102, 103 is like really good defense, really bad offense per 100 possessions, roughly. Okay, so basically all this play type data does, and like I said, it's only available for the last 3 or 4 years when we have these cameras that literally record millions of data points of where every player, all 10 players and the basketball were every quarter, like, you know, millisecond, the whole game. And all these guys who are super good at coding have managed to take all that data and figure out what play type each play was. Was it a pick and roll? Was it an isolation? Was it a spot up off screen? Whatever, post up. And then show how well each player did in each of those situations. And so then also what you can do, and again, on this website, NBA Math, it's one of like my 3 or 4 favorite sports stats, basketball stats websites. They can actually categorize each player by percentile in the league in each of these categories. So what this website is telling you basically is that, you know, I have Kevin Durant up right now. My computer just froze. I had Kevin Durant up. And basically what it's telling you is when Kevin Durant isolates, he's going to score, you know, 1 point. I'm making the numbers up because my computer's frozen, but he's going to score, like, say 1.02 points per 100 possession, points per possession when he scores, when he isolates. And that's in the 85th percentile, let's say, of the NBA. And so this is telling you that, like, also helps you figure out what plays are better on average. Like, transition is always way better than isolation. And, you know, pick and rolls are better than isolation. But sometimes you need an isolation when the shot clock's running down or stuff like that. So what's really cool about this stat, these stats, is that it goes hand in hand with watching the game. It helps you know, when you're watching a game, oh, I want my team, my team's really good. This player in particular, my team in general, is really good at these play types. I want these players running the pick and roll with each other because I know that, like, this guy's in the 90th percentile of the NBA as a pick and roll roll man, and this guy's like high as a pick and roll ball handler. So I think this type of data is really cool. On this website that I'm looking at, they only have it for the 2016-17 season. But on nba.com/stats, they do have play type data. I don't find it to be as user friendly, so I end up seeing other people blog and tweet about these stats more than I find them myself, just because I think the website's not super user friendly yet, or at least I haven't figured out how to use it. But I think it's like a super cool stat category for thinking about how you want to structure your team's offense and what's working well for which players. Which also, one thing that's really cool about that is that the problem with lineup data is that context matters a lot. Like if you add Clint Capela to a team that already has Dwight Howard, he might have a negative impact. But if you add Clint Capela to a team that has four shooters and needs like a rim running center, rim protector, you might have a huge positive impact. And it's really difficult for lineup data to say anything about context. So when a guy gets added to a new team, the lineup data is actually not super predictive of how even his own like real plus minus will be on the new team, just because like real plus minus depends a lot on what your teammates need from you. And so what's cool about the play type data is that if you know your new team needs a pick and roll ball handler because there are no other ball handlers, and you know that that guy's not good at that, then you can predict that even though Trevor Ariza, let's say, was really good on the Rockets, he would be actually not that good on some team like, I don't know, some team that like really needs a ball handler. And you can project, you know, Carmelo is going to the Rockets and he was actually like a pretty good spot up shooter, but was actually really bad in isolation last year. So if the Rockets keep him as a spot up shooter like Trevor Ariza was, maybe he won't hurt their offense too much. But if they go to a bunch of Carmelo ISOs like the Thunder did a lot of times last year, that's going to really wreck them. And then a couple more quick things that I really like about play type data. There's this really cool statistic, and I don't think it's publicly available, but sometimes you see teams blogging about it. So the Warriors actually, some of my friends from college started a sports stats company called MoCap Analytics a few years ago. And they used to do the stats on the Warriors graphics online, and the Warriors really liked this particular statistic, which is basically that now we can tell exactly how hard your shots are in a couple of dimensions, because we know from the tracking data exactly how far you were from the basket. So a 35-foot three is harder than a normal 23-foot three, and we know how far the closest defender was. So at least in two, obviously those aren't the only things. You could have been off balance or something. We can't see that. But we know how close you were to the basket and how close the closest defender was. So in some sense, we know how hard every shot was. And what that allows us to do that's really, really cool is know whether your team was scoring more points because you got better shots or because you had better shooters, which can be related things, but actually kind of different things. So for a particular game, when I'm watching a game and I'm trying to figure out, like if it's game one of a playoff series and I'm trying to figure out, like, is my team overmatched or are they just having a bad game? I always think like, oh, they missed a bunch of open shots. That was bad luck. And like now we actually have a way to quantify that because we know how open their shots were and we know how well they shot relative to how well they would be expected to shoot. So basically, quantified shot quality is what is the NBA average for that particular shot? So for with a defender 3 feet away for an 18-foot shot, what is the average NBA player shot over the season? And then quantified shooter impact is what did that shooter shoot for that particular shot relative to the NBA average? So DeAndre Jordan has extremely high shooting percentages, but probably very little quantified shooter impact because he mostly shoots dunks that everyone in the NBA shoots at 99%, whereas Steph Curry is shooting off the dribble contested 28 footers that no one else in the NBA can make. And so Steph Curry, here I have a 538 article from a couple years ago, had his quantified shooter impact was 13%. Which means that he was adding 13% over what an average NBA player would shoot, which is the best in the league, at least as far as data had been collected for this article, which is a couple years old. So that means if the average NBA player had Steph Curry's shot selection for the whole season, their shooting percentage would be 13% worse. So this is the kind of stuff that I feel like the play type data, I think, is most useful for coaches and people who are thinking about team strategy and like how do I want my team to play basketball? Because what we're able to do now is take stuff that usually you would have to watch thousands of hours of film to be like, oh, this guy running the pick and roll from the right side of the court is like usually pretty successful. You'd have to like get that off mental repetition and essentially memorizing kind of results from watching thousands of hours of film. And now you can just, the teams have this. Fans only have like a little bits and pieces of this right now. But now you can just be like, oh, like, what do Steph and Draymond versus Steph and Looney versus Steph and JaVale pick and rolls from the left side of the court do versus the right side of the court? And, you know, like, stuff like that. So I think actually the play type data is the coolest data. It's the least accessible right now, but I'm sure it'll get more and more accessible as we progress forward.
Well, I was going to start working on a photo of Wilt Chamberlain in Photoshop your head onto Wilt Chamberlain's body, and instead of the 100 points on the piece of paper, just put lineup data on there, because that was an impressive run that you just got on. So what stats are you going to be the most interested in, like, in this season? Would that be in the fourth bucket, the one that you just mentioned? Like, the,
it's honestly, yeah, it's a little inaccessible. I think my favorite stat is still real plus minus. And that's the one I look at the most. I really like the player impact plus minus too, just because it's a little bit more projectable than real plus minus in terms of like guys moving around teams and stuff. But my favorite stats are definitely the fourth bucket. The play type stats, I'm all over. Like, I want to know everything about who's defending the pick and roll well on the Bulls and who's defending it badly and stuff like that. It's still, play type data is still bad at help defense though. Like, if you're the guy who's supposed to help the two guys guarding the pick and roll and you're not in the right spot, like, we don't know that. And that's part of why I like the lineup data, because it covers up the flaws that are, it's kind of like the best we can do at trying to cover up the flaws of all the other stats.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, I hope that was educational for the listeners out there and that you understand advanced stats a little bit better. Now, if anyone has any questions or any advanced stats that we did not talk about that they find interesting, hit us up at Takes of the Game on Twitter. You can find me at The T Young and Ishan at Shoulda Kept JB. And yeah, I feel like we'll probably keep talking about this over the next couple weeks. Let us know why you love the NBA, what attracted you to it, why you're going to continue to love it in the future. Ishan, you got anything else?
I'm good. This was super fun. It is literally my job to talk about statistics.
Cool. We will see you guys next week.